He asked what he could do for her, and she said, "Build a better club. For everyone." So he promised. He's never been good with words. Never been the kind of dad who could tell his kids and his wife how much he loves them. He's always hoped that just showing them he did would be enough. But how can he show them anything now? Beyond the fact that he's a loser. He pulls up at a pedestrian crossing. A young father is crossing the road with his daughter, 8 or 9 years old. The father is holding her hand, and the girl is making it very plain that she thinks she's way too old for that. Peter has to stop himself getting out of the car and shouting at the father to never let go. Never let go. Never. When Peter and Kira had their first child, Isak, Kira said to him, "This is what we are now. Everything else comes after this. First and foremost, we're parents." Peter already knew, of course. All parents know. It's not a voluntary process. It's an emotional assault. You become someone else's property the first time you hear your child cry. You belong to that little person now. Before everything else. So when something happens to your child, it never stops being your fault. Peter feels like leaping out of the car and shouting at that father, "Never let her out of your sight. Never trust anyone, and don't let her go to that party." When Isak died, people asked, "How does anyone get over that?" Peter's only response is that you don't. You just carry on living. Some of your emotional register switches to autopilot. But now, he doesn't know. He just knows that when something happens to your child, it doesn't make any difference whose fault it is, because it never stops being your fault, regardless. Why weren't you there? Why didn't you kill him? Why weren't you enough? Peter wants to shout at the dad crossing the road, "Never let go, because those bastards will take your whole lives away from you." Instead, he just cries quietly, his fingernails embedded in the steering wheel. The Island. It was summer, and the island was ours. We had had winter for 1,000 years. You were broken. I was cracked. You hung the rope. I tied the knot. How many times did we have time to die before we turned 16? How many songs about saying goodbye that only you know what they mean? But this was summer, and the island was ours, and you are mine for 1,000 years. Kira used to fall asleep on the sofa when Peter got home late. An unopened bottle of wine and 2 glasses on the table. A silent little dart of guilty conscience to remind him that she'd been waiting for him. That his not coming home actually hurt someone. He used to pick her up gently and carry her to bed, then fall asleep, breathing hard against her back. A long marriage consists of such small things that when they get lost, we don't even know where to start looking for them. The way she usually touches him, as if she didn't mean to, when he's washing up and she's making coffee, and her little finger overlaps his when they put their hands down on the kitchen counter together. His lips brush her hair fleetingly as he passes her at the kitchen table, the two of them looking different ways. Two people who have loved each other for long enough eventually seem to stop touching each other consciously. It becomes something instinctive. When they meet between the hall and kitchen, their bodies somehow find each other. When they walk through a door, her hand ends up in his as if by accident. Tiny collisions, every day, all the time. Impossible to construct. So when they disappear, no one knows why, but suddenly 2 people are living parallel lives instead of together. One morning they don't make eye contact. Their fingers land a few inches farther apart along the counter. They pass each other in a hallway. They no longer bump into each other. It's past midnight by the time Peter opens the front door. Kira knows he's hoping she's asleep, so she pretends to be. The wine bottle on the table is empty. There's only one glass beside it. He doesn't carry her to bed, just covers her clumsily with a blanket where she lies on the sofa. He stands there for a few moments. Perhaps he's waiting for her to stop pretending. But when she opens her eyes, he's in the bathroom. He locks the door, stares down at the floor. She lies on the sofa, stares at the ceiling. They don't know if they have anything to say to each other anymore. Everything has a breaking point. And even though people always say that a joy shared is a joy doubled, we seem to insist on believing that the opposite is true of sorrow. Perhaps that isn't actually the case. Two drowning people with lead weights around their ankles may not be each other's salvation. If they hold hands, they'll just sink twice as fast. In the end, the weight of carrying each other's broken hearts becomes unbearable. They sleep out of reach of each other's fingertips, with no lips against hair, no breath against back. And night after night, a single question slowly takes root inside both of their heads. Is this how it starts? When a relationship breaks down? Chapter 9. He's going to need someone to fight tonight. Everyone who loves sports knows that a game isn't decided only by what happens, but just as much by what doesn't. The shot that hits the post, the bad call by the referee, the pass that didn't quite connect. Every discussion about sports dissolves, sooner or later, into 1,000 ifs and 10,000 if only that hadn'ts. Some people's lives get stuck the same way, year after year passing by with the same story being repeated to strangers at an ever more deserted bar counter. A doomed relationship, a dishonest business partner. An unfair dismissal, ungrateful kids, an accident, a divorce. One single reason why everything went to hell. When it comes down to it, everyone has something to say about the life he should have had instead of this one. Cities and towns work the same way. So if you want to understand their biggest stories, first you have to listen to the smaller ones. The council building is left almost empty after midsummer as the politicians take their holidays or spend time at their regular jobs. If you want to understand how the local council is run, that's where you have to start. Politics here is a part-time occupation, and the salary of just a few thousand kroner a month makes it almost an act of charity when seen in relation to the number of hours worked. So most councillors are employed elsewhere or have their own businesses, meaning that they have customers and suppliers and bosses and colleagues. Naturally, this makes it difficult to claim to be truly independent, but no man is an island, especially not this deep into the forest. One single counselor goes on working 18 hours a day in the council building throughout the summer, and he doesn't owe anything to anyone around here. His name is Richard Tew, and he sits in his office in a black suit, making a stream of phone calls. He is hated by some and feared by many, and soon he will change the direction of one hockey club and two towns. Several days of rain follow, and Beartown becomes a different place. The town isn't as used to this sort of precipitation as it is to snow. People stay indoors, quieter and more irritable than usual. The jeep drives through the mud up into the forest, and the stranger stops outside a small garage beside a shabby-looking house. Cars are parked on the grass, waiting to be repaired. One of them is difficult to avoid. It has an axe sticking out of the hood. The stranger sees an 18-year-old youth with fists the size of piglets jump up onto the chassis and pull the axe out of the metal, his shoulders so tense that his neck seems to retract into his guts. A gruff-looking man in his 40s, so similar to the young man that there's no way the postman would ever have to take a paternity test, walks over to the jeep and taps on the window. "Tires?" he grunts. The stranger winds the window down and repeats uncomprehendingly, "Tires?" The man kicks the front wheel. They're worn smooth. This one's got grooves no deeper than an old LP, so I assume that's why you're here. Okay, the stranger says. Okay, do you want new tires or not? The man wonders. Okay, the stranger says, and shrugs as if the man was asking about ketchup on a burger. The man grunts something inaudible and yells, Bobo, have we got tires for this one? The stranger obviously isn't here to get the tires changed, but to assess the quality of a defensive player. But if that's going to require a change of tires, then so be it. So the stranger watches the 18-year-old, Bobo, whose efforts pulling the axe from the car hood remind the stranger of a cut-price King Arthur. He disappears into the workshop, where there are no pictures of scantily clad women on the walls, from which the stranger concludes that there's a woman in the house whom the father and son are unwilling to cross. There are, however, pictures of ice hockey teams, new and old alike. The stranger nods to them, then at Bobo when he comes back with a tire under each arm, and asks the father, That lad of yours, is he any good as a player? The father suddenly lights up with the sort of pride you only have if you've been a defenseman yourself. Bobo? Yes, toughest defenseman in town. His choice of the word toughest doesn't surprise the stranger, because both father and son give the distinct impression of being the sort of men who can skate in only one direction. The father holds out a grease-stained hand, and the stranger shakes it with the enthusiasm of someone invited to take hold of a snake. People call me Hog, the father grins. Zach Hell, the stranger says. The stranger leaves the workshop with an improved set of secondhand tires for a little more than the going rate, and a scrap of paper. Bobo, if he can learn to skate. The sheet of paper isn't just a list. It's a team sheet. Amit runs alone along the road, with his shirt black with sweat, until his eyes are streaming and his brain is empty of all thought. He's one of the brightest hockey talents this town has ever seen, but no one realized it until this spring. He lives with his mom in one of the cheapest apartment blocks at the far end of the hollow in the north of Beartown. He's always played with secondhand equipment, and he's been told he's too small. But no one is faster on skates than he is. Kill them, his best friends usually say, instead of good luck. His speed is his weapon. Hockey is the sport of bears around here, but Amit taught himself to play it like a lion. The sport became his way into the community, and he thought it could be his ticket out as well. His mother works as a cleaner in the ice rink in the winter and in the hospital during the summer, but one day Amit hopes to turn professional and take her away from here. Back in the spring, he got his chance with the junior team. He grabbed it. He showed everyone in town that he was a winner, and the path to his dreams lay open. It was the best day and the worst night of his life. After the game, he was invited to a party that Maya Anderson was also going to, and the only thing Amit had ever dreamed of more than playing was being allowed to kiss her. He was drunk, but even so, he will never forget every detail of how he stumbled through room after room of drunk and high teenagers singing and laughing, went upstairs, and heard Maya calling for help. Amit opened a door and saw the rape. When Kevin realized what Amit had seen, he and William Leet and some of the other boys in the junior team offered Amit everything the boy had dreamed of. A place on the junior team, star status, a career, in exchange for keeping his mouth shut. Kevin's father gave him money and promised to get his mother a better job. If anyone condemns Amit for giving the offer serious consideration, that person has lived a life where morality is easy. It never is. Morality is a luxury. Kevin's parents and the club sponsors called a meeting and tried to force Maya's father out of the club. In the end, Amit went to the meeting, stood up at the front, and told everyone what he had seen Kevin do. Peter Anderson won the vote of confidence and kept his job. And then what? Amit is running faster now. His feet hurt more. because what the hell happened next? Kevin was never punished. Maya never got justice, and Amit left that meeting with hundreds of enemies. Leet and his friends found him and beat him up, and if Bobo hadn't changed sides at the last minute and defended Amit, they would have killed him. Neither Amit nor Bobo is welcome at Hiad Hockey Club now. Amit is a snitch and Bobo a traitor. And Beartown Ice Hockey? Soon it won't exist anymore. Amit is on his way to becoming one of those people who sits at a bar counter in 30 years' time with a story full of ifs and if only that hadn'ts. He's seen them in the rink. Shabby men with 3 days' worth of stubble and 4 days' worth of hangover, whose lives peaked while they were still teenagers. Amit could have turned professional. His life could have changed. But instead, he's on his way to becoming a has-been at the age of 16. His gaze is focused inward. He doesn't even notice the jeep behind him. When it passes him, he doesn't know it was 50 yards behind him for several minutes, so that the stranger could make a note of how far he is from Beartown and how fast he's running. The stranger writes, "Amit, if his heart is as big as his lungs." Benji is sitting with his back against his father's headstone. His body is full of moonshine and grass, and the combination acts as a circuit breaker. He's closing down. Can't bear it otherwise. He has 3 older sisters, and you can tell the difference between them if you mention his name. Gabby has young children. She reads them bedtime stories, goes to bed early on Friday nights, and still watches TV programs on TV instead of a computer. Katya is a bartender at the barn in Hid. She spends her Friday nights pouring beer and shepherding 300-pound drunks through the door when they decide to try to relieve other 300-pound drunks of their front teeth. Audrey is the eldest. She lives alone at her boarding kennels outside Beartown. She hunts and fishes and likes people who keep their mouths shut. So if you say, "Benji," Gabby will exclaim anxiously, "Has something happened to him?" Katya will sigh and wonder, "What's he done now?" But Audrey will force you up against a wall and demand, "What the hell do you want with my brother?" Gabby worries, Katya solves problems, Audrey protects. That's been the division of responsibilities since their father took his rifle and went out into the forest. They know they can't teach a heart like Benji's, but they might be able to tame it. So when he lives like a nomad, staying sometimes at his mother's, sometimes out in the forest, sometimes with one of his sisters, they fall into their old roles. If he's at Gabby's, she still gets up at night to check that he's breathing, even though he's 18 years old. When he sees Katya, she still spoils him, lets him get away with way too much shit, because she doesn't want him to stop coming to her with his problems. And when he's staying out at the kennels with Audrey, she sleeps with the key to the gun cabinet under her pillow, to make sure her little brother doesn't do the same thing as their father. There have always been adults in this town who have thought that Benji is a rebel. His sisters know that the exact opposite is true. He became precisely the person everyone wanted him to be, because a young boy carrying a huge secret soon learns that sometimes the best place to hide it is where everyone can see you. As a child, Benji was the first person to recognize that Kevin could be a star. In Beartown, players like that are called cherry trees. So Benji saw to it that Kevin got enough space on the ice to blossom. Benji could give and take so much rough treatment that men in the stands used to say, "Now there's a real hockey player. This isn't a sport for fags and weaklings, it's for guys like Benji." The more he fought, the better they thought they knew him. Until he became the person they wanted him to be. He's 18 now. He gets up and leans on the headstone, kisses his father's name. Then he takes a step back, clenches his fist as tightly as he can, and punches the same place with full force. Blood drips from his knuckles as he makes his way through the forest toward Hied. Tomorrow would have been Alan Ovich's birthday, and this is the first time that Benji is celebrating it without Kevin. He's going to need someone to fight tonight. He never sees the jeep. It's standing parked beneath a tree. The stranger walks through the rain to the grave, looks at the name engraved in the stone. Back in the jeep, a pen scratches on a sheet of paper. Ovich, if he still wants to play. Benji, Amit, Bobo. Inside every large story, there are always plenty of small ones. While three young men in Beartown thought they were in the process of losing their club, a stranger was already constructing a team with them. Richard Tew, the politician, is alone in the council building when evening falls. He looks younger than his 40 years, a genetic quirk he used to hate when he inspected his impassively hairless testicles as he waited for the onset of puberty, but from which he is now reaping the rewards as his contemporaries pluck gray hairs from their beards and curse the law of gravity every time they pee. Tew is wearing a suit. At best, his colleagues wear jeans and a jacket, so he's used to being mocked for looking like a government minister even though he's just a nobody from the provinces. It doesn't bother him. He doesn't dress for the job he's got, but for the one he wants. He grew up in Beartown, but was never one of the popular kids, never played hockey. He went abroad to study, and no one noticed he was gone. He worked in a bank in London and was gone for years before he suddenly came home with expensive suits and political ambitions. He joined the smallest political party in the area. It isn't the smallest anymore. Not long ago, Tew was the sort of face that former classmates would see in old school photographs and not remember his name. But that changed when the local paper shone a negative light on his politics. But how they learned his name is unimportant to Tew, as long as they know it. Opinions can be changed. He wasn't at the meeting where Peter was informed of the fate of Beartown Ice Hockey Club, because Richard Tew isn't part of the establishment. All councils have a political elite that you either belong to or you don't, and the establishment here has chosen to freeze Tew out. Naturally, they claim it's because of his politics, but he's convinced that the real reason is that they fear him. He can get the people on his side. They call him a populist, but the only difference between him and the other parties is that he doesn't need flags. They have their offices on the top floor of the council building and play golf with business leaders, whereas Richard Tew has his office on the ground floor. He collects his information from people who have lost their jobs, rather than from the people firing them. From the people who are angry, instead of the ones who are happy. So he doesn't need flags to tell him which way the wind is blowing. While all the other politicians are running in the same direction, men like Richard Tew go the other way. And sometimes that's how they win. There's a knock on his office door. It's late. No one has seen the stranger arrive. There you are at last. Well, have you finished thinking about it? Are you going to take the job? Richard Tew asks without further ado. The stranger stands in the doorway with a pocket containing the sheet of paper with the names of the team players on it. But Zakel's reply is so apathetic that it's hard to tell if it's because of a lack of enthusiasm about the job or life in general. When you called me, you offered me the job of coach of Beartown Ice Hockey's A team. But the club's going into receivership. And even if it weren't, it already has a coach. And even if it didn't, you're still a politician rather than the club's general manager. So unless I've seriously misunderstood the democratic process, you can't offer me a job as a coach any more than you can offer me a unicorn. Yet you're still here, Richard Tew says simply. I happen to be very fond of unicorns. Zakel confesses in a way that makes it impossible to tell if the remark is supposed to be funny or not. Tew tilts his head to one side. Coffee? I don't drink coffee. I don't like hot drinks. Tew jerks as if he's trying to avoid a dagger. You don't drink coffee? You're going to have trouble fitting into this town. This town isn't alone in that, Zakel replies. Tew chuckles. You're a very strange person, Zakel. So I've been told. Tew slaps his hands on his desk and stands up cheerfully. I like that. The media will like it too. The coaching job is yours. Let me worry about the general manager. I look forward to the two of us working together. He looks as though he's considering attempting a high five. Zakel looks very much as though that isn't going to happen. My main ambition is that you and I will never have to work together. I'm here for the hockey, not politics. Chiu throws his arms out brightly. I hate hockey. You can have that all to yourself. Zakel's hands are firmly embedded in the pockets of the tracksuit. For someone who hates hockey, you seem to be very involved in it. Chiu's eyes narrow contentedly. That's because when everyone else runs the same way, I go the other way, Zakel. That's how I win. Chapter 10. How do you tell your children? The lights in the law firm are switched off, except for in one office. Kira Anderson is working while her colleague is lying across two armchairs looking for package holidays on her computer. A package holiday? You don't even like taking time off, Kira points out. Her colleague stretches like a cat that's been told off. I don't, but with this body, Kira, it would be a crime against humanity if it didn't get shown off in a bikini at least once a year. Kira laughs. How wonderful that her colleague can still make her do that so easily, that she has a friend like her. Tell me when you've booked so I can call and warn the country in question to keep all its husbands locked away. Her colleague nods seriously. And sons. And dads, if I've drunk enough Fernet. Kira smiles, then she blinks slowly and mutters, thanks for being here. Her colleague shrugs her shoulders. The Wi-Fi at home is bad. Which is rubbish, of course. She's still at work because she knows Kira doesn't want to go home early tonight and sit in an empty house waiting for Peter. She doesn't judge. She doesn't go on about it. She just stays behind in the only office where the lights are still on. How wonderful to have a friend like that. Never love a hockey club. It can never love you back, Peter's mother told him that. She was softer than his dad, although sometimes Peter thinks his dad might have been softer, too, before she got sick. Never believe you're anything special, his dad said. Peter evidently didn't listen to either of them. He's called everyone he knows, everyone he's played with, asked for advice, asked for money, asked for players to save the club. Everyone understands, everyone sympathizes. But hockey is built on statistics and figures. No one gives you anything for nothing. His phone rings. It's his childhood friend Tails, the supermarket owner and Beartown Ice Hockey's last real sponsor. Tails' voice is trembling when he says, This is so fucked, Peter. It's so fucking fucked. They've posted something. What? Peter asks. I wanted to call you so you can stop the kids seeing it. The bastards, there's a death notice in the local paper today. Your name. Peter says nothing. He understands the message. You can tell yourself as much as you like that the criticism belongs to the job and that you shouldn't let it bother you. But we're all only human. If your name appears in a death notice, it bothers you. Ignore them, Tails advises, even though he knows it's impossible. It might be possible to save a hockey club in Beartown, even if you don't have everyone on your side. But not if everyone's against you. Peter hangs up. He ought to go home, but Maya's camping with Anna and Leo is sleeping over at a friend's. Peter and Kira will be alone in the house, and he knows what she's going to say. She's going to try to persuade him to give up. So Peter turns the Volvo around and drives, out of Beartown, off along the road, faster and faster. On the wall of Richard Teo's office hangs a picture of a stork. Teo has studied statistics and knows that the simplest way to influence people's opinions is to demonstrate a connection. Bad diet leads to illness. Alcohol causes road accidents. poverty generates crime. He also knows that numbers can be massaged to suit a politician's needs. In a book by a British statistician, Tew learned, for instance, that there are statistics showing that the number of children born each year is much greater in towns where there are storks than in towns where there aren't many storks. What does this prove? That storks deliver babies, the statistician wrote sarcastically. Of course, that isn't the case. There are more storks in towns with a lot of chimneys because that's where they build their nests. A lot of chimneys means a lot of houses, which means more people, which means more babies. So Richard Tew has a picture of a stork on the wall of his office to provide him with a daily reminder that whatever is happening isn't important. The important thing is how you explain it to people. He's interested in other animals, too, such as bears and bulls. Like all the other children around here, he grew up knowing that those were the names of the hockey clubs. But when he started to study economics abroad, he learned a different story. On Wall Street, brokers call an optimistic market with rising share prices a bull market, and the slow, remorseless downward movement of the market in a recession is a bear market. The idea is that both are necessary, that the conflict between the two keeps the economy in balance. Richard Tew has the same idea about the hockey clubs, but his goal is to alter the balance. Because political elections are simple. When everything is going well, when people are happy, the establishment wins. But when people are angry and arguing, people like Richard Tew win. Because for an outsider to win power requires a conflict. But if there's no conflict, you have to create one. He dials the number of an old friend in London. Is everyone agreed? He asks. Yes, everyone's on board, but you appreciate that the new owners require certain political guarantees, his London friend says. They'll get what they want, just make sure they show up here and look happy in the pictures for the local paper, Tew says. And what do you want? I just want to be their friend, Tew insists. His London friend laughs. Yeah, right, as usual. It's a good deal for the new owners, Richard promises. His London friend agrees. A very good deal, no doubt about it, and it couldn't have happened without your specialist knowledge and political contacts. The new owners appreciate your help. But seriously, why are you so interested in the factory? Tew's voice is gentle. Because the factory's in Beartown. I need it because it's going to give me a hockey club. His London friend laughs again. When he and Tew met at university in England, Tew had only a small academic grant and empty pockets. His mother was a teacher and his father a factory worker, but his dad was active in the union and had gained a reputation as such a tough negotiator that legend has it that the factory managers gave him a job in middle management simply so they wouldn't have to negotiate with him. His dad grew fat and comfortable, and soon he wasn't at all dangerous. That taught Richard Tew what it was possible to do with power. So when he got to university, he consciously sought out a particular type of man, those from wealthy families who were also weak and bullied and had low self-confidence. Tew was quick-witted and funny, a good friend and excellent company at parties, as well as being pretty good at talking to girls. Those are valuable qualities anywhere. In return, he acquired loyal friends who soon inherited money and power from their parents. That taught Tew the value of contacts. When he got home to Beartown, he could have joined any political party, but he chose the smallest, for the same reason he had chosen to start his political career in Beartown instead of a larger city. Sometimes it's more effective to be a big fish in a small pond than a small one in a big pond. Political affiliations and colors were unimportant to him. He would have been just as happy on the extreme right or extreme left. Some people are driven by ideals, but Richard Tew was driven by results. Other politicians say he's an opportunist with simple answers to difficult questions, the sort who one moment is standing with unemployed men in the bearskin pub promising council investment, the next is hobnobbing with the bosses on the heights promising lower taxes. He seeks out simple scapegoats every time a crime is committed in the Hollow so that he can call in the local paper for more police while simultaneously criticizing the establishment for not sticking to the council budget. He sits with environmentalists and promises to stop the hunting lobby's influence on local politics, but when it suits his agenda, he sits in other rooms and fans the hunters' frustration with the wolf-huggers in the big cities and the gun-haters in government agencies. Tiu is, of course, supremely ambivalent about the criticism, because it's just another way of saying that he doesn't need flags. Politics is about strategy, not dreams. So what situations can he exploit this summer? There have long been rumors that the hospital in Hied is going to be shut down. The factory in Beartown has been cutting its staff for years. And now Beartown Ice Hockey is threatened with bankruptcy. You need to know a good deal about wind to understand how to win something from all three of those. A hockey club? I didn't think you liked sports, his London friend says in surprise. I like things that are useful to me, Richard Tiu says. Two women, Fatima and Anne Katrine, are sitting in a small car on their way through the forest. Their sons, Ahmet and Bobo, became teammates in the spring, and the bear on their sons' jerseys brought the mothers together as well. Anne Katrine works as a nurse in the hospital that Fatima cleans in the summers, so they started having coffee together and realized that although the places of birth in their passports may have been a very great distance apart, they share the same mentality. Work hard, laugh loud, and love your children with everything you've got. To start with, of course, much of their conversation revolved around the rumors that the hospital was going to be closed. Fatima told Anne Katrine that one of the first things she learned to say in the Beartown dialect, where she had just arrived with a little boy in her arms, was, "That's going to be difficult." Fatima loved the people here because they didn't try to pretend that the world was uncomplicated. Life is tough, it hurts, and people admitted that. But then they grinned and said, "What the hell, it's supposed to be hard. Otherwise every bugger in the big cities would be able to do it." Anne Katrine related stories of her own, about her parents, who died young, and about growing up in the forest as the economy was getting worse, and about falling in love with a big, clumsy man called Hog, because he played hockey like a wounded wild boar and could skate only in a straight line at full speed. Anne Katrine had never traveled, had never seen the world, had never felt the need. "The most beautiful trees are here," she promised Fatima, adding, "and the men aren't too bad either, if you're patient." Hog and their three children, Bobo is the eldest, have kept Anne Katrine busy. She gets up early, feeds and clothes them, helps Hog with the paperwork in the workshop, then goes to the hospital and works long shifts full of the worst days in other people's lives, then home again. Homework to be done and the house to sort out and tears to be wiped from cheeks from time to time. But in the evenings, she told Fatima, Hog creeps through the kitchen more softly than a man of his bulk ought to be able to. And when he holds her, when she turns around close to him and they dance, with her toes on his feet so that he's carrying her whole weight with every little step, it's all worth it. It becomes the whole world. "Do you remember when the children were really small, Fatima? When you'd get to preschool and they'd run toward you and literally jump up into your arms? Jump with complete abandon because they trusted us to catch them. That's my favorite moment in the whole world." Fatima smiles and says, "Do you know what? When Ahmet plays hockey, when he's happy, I still feel like that. Do you know what I mean?" Anne Katrine knows exactly. That was how they became friends. When Anne Katrine collapsed in the cafeteria of the hospital one afternoon a few weeks ago, it was Fatima who caught her. She was one of the first people Anne Katrine told about her illness. Fatima went with her to doctor's appointments, drove her to see specialists at another hospital so that Hog could stay at home and run the garage. They're sitting in the car now, almost home, and Anne Katrine smiles tiredly. "You do too much for me." Fatima replies firmly, "Do you know what I learned when I came to Beartown? That if we don't look after each other, No one else will. Bears shit in the forest, and everyone else shits on Bear Town, Aunt Katrine says in the voice of the drunk old uncles in the bearskin, and the two women laugh out loud. As they pull up on the grass in front of the workshop, Fatima whispers, You have to tell Bobo that you're ill. I know, Aunt Katrine sniffs with her face in her hands. She wanted to wait until the hockey season had started so Bobo would have somewhere to take his feelings. But there isn't time. So how do you do it? How do you tell your children that you're going to die? The barn is a bar on the outskirts of Hied. It has live music and cheap beer, and like all similar places, it's become a natural meeting place for people who are trying to forget their problems, as well as for the people who are looking for them. Katya Ovich is sitting in the office huddled over the accounts when one of the bouncers knocks on the doorframe. I know you didn't want to be disturbed, but your little brother's sitting in the bar, in his t-shirt. Katya lowers her head and lets out a deep sigh. Then she gets up, pats the bouncer on the shoulder, and promises to take care of it. Sure enough, Benji is sitting in the bar, which in itself isn't a problem. He's pretty much grown up in the barn, and when it's been short of staff, he's stood behind the bar serving beer long before he was old enough to buy it for himself. But things are different now. The regulars in the barn support Hied hockey, but they've let Benji come for three reasons. One, the regulars like Katya. Two, Benji has been only a junior player in Beartown. Three, he's had the sense to wear long sleeves. But he's 18 now, and if he plays hockey this autumn, he'll be on the A-team, and he's sitting at the bar wearing a t-shirt so that everyone can see the tattoo of the bear on his arm. The same week, someone has posted a clip online of red Hied hockey flags burning, and a politician in Hied who spoke in public about the possible bankruptcy of Beartown ice hockey ended up with an axe in the hood of her car. Are you going to put a top on? Katya asks when she arrives behind the bar. Benji smiles. Hello, favorite sister. That was always his trick when he was little, and her weakness was that she could never get angry because she wanted him to love her most. She sighs sadly. Please, Benji, can't you just do this somewhere else? She gestures toward his beer glass. Katya knows she can't stop anyone in her family from doing anything. She learned that early in life. Tomorrow would have been their dad's birthday. Don't worry, favorite sister, Benji says, as though she has a choice. She looks beseechingly at him. Finish your beer and then go home, okay? I just need to finish the accounts. I'll be done in 15 minutes. Benji leans over the bar and kisses her cheek. She feels like both hugging him and hitting him, the same as usual. She looks around the bar. It isn't even a quarter full, and most of the people here are either too old or too drunk to worry about Benji's tattoo. Katya hopes she can get him out of here before that changes. When Ahmet's legs have no strength left, he turns and runs back along the road more slowly. Halfway home, he encounters a Volvo. It's Peter Anderson's. Maybe Ahmet should stop himself. Maybe he should have more dignity. But he starts jumping up and down and waving frantically. The car slows down, almost unwillingly. Ahmet leans in through the wound-down window, and the words bubble out of him breathlessly. Hi, Peter, I just wanted to ask, all the talk about the club, is there going to be a junior team in the autumn? I want to play, I have... Peter shouldn't have stopped the car. Should have known himself better than to take out his feelings on a 16-year-old boy. For a moment, he forgets what Ahmet did back in the spring, that the reason why the junior player can't go to Hied now is that he testified on behalf of Maya, saved Peter's job. But sometimes grief and rage can consume a grown man so completely that he can't actually consider the fact that other people have feelings, too. Ahmet, I've got a lot on my mind. We'll have to talk about it another time. When? I've got nowhere to play, Ahmet blurts out breathlessly. He may not have meant to sound angry, but he's frightened. Peter's guilty conscience threatens to suffocate him, and at times like that, sometimes the right places in our hearts don't get enough oxygen. So he snaps back, Are you having trouble hearing me, Amit? I don't give a damn about the junior team. I don't even know if I've got a club. Only then does Amit see that Peter's been crying. The boy backs away slowly from the car. Peter drives away, utterly crushed. In the rain, he didn't see the tears running down the boy's cheeks as well. A man is sitting in the bar of the barn, 25, maybe 27, blue jeans, polo shirt. He's drinking beer and has a book open in front of him. When Katya goes back to the office, he raises an eyebrow in Benji's direction and asks, "Should I move?" Benji turns toward him with the sort of carefree little quiver of the corners of his lips that people find very hard not to find infectious. "What for?" The man in the polo shirt smiles. "Your sister seems to think you're going to get in trouble, so I'm wondering if I should move."
"That depends how much you like trouble," Benji replies and drinks some of his beer.
The man in the polo shirt nods. He glances at Benji's hand and sees the blood on his knuckles. "I've lived here for 4 hours. How quickly is it reasonable to get into trouble?"
"Kind of depends how long you're thinking of staying. What's the book?"
The question comes so out of the blue that the man momentarily doesn't know what to say. Then he realizes that perhaps that was the point. Benji has many ways of making other people feel uncertain.
It's a biography of Friedrich Nietzsche, the man in the polo shirt says and clears his throat. "The guy with the abyss?" Benji asks.
The man in the polo shirt looks surprised. "If you look long into the abyss also looks into you."
"Yes, that's Nietzsche."
"You look surprised," Benji observes.
"No," the man lies.
Benji drinks his beer. For many years, his mother had a way of punishing him for fighting in school by forcing him to read the newspaper. He wasn't allowed to go to hockey practice until she'd tested him on everything. The editorial, the foreign news, culture, politics. After a few years, that got too easy for him, so his mother started to use literary classics instead. She could hardly read them herself, but she knew her son was smarter than he let anyone believe. So his punishment for misbehavior was also a reminder, "You're better than this." Benji sniggers at the man in the polo shirt.
"Were you expecting me to trot out 'What doesn't kill you makes you stronger' when you mentioned Nietzsche? Or maybe 'In heaven, all the interesting people are missing,' or how does it go? 'And those who were seen dancing were thought to be insane by those who couldn't hear the music.'"
"I don't think that last one is Nietzsche," the man replies cautiously. Benji drinks his beer in a way that makes it impossible for the man to know if it was a mistake or a test. Then he says,
"You still look surprised."
No. "Okay, to be honest, you don't look like someone who'd quote Nietzsche," the man says, laughing.
"There are lots of things I don't look like," Benji says.
The corners of his mouth are dancing again. Bobo and his mother go for a long walk in the forest that evening. She wants to tell him how hard it is to be an adult, how complex the world is, but she doesn't know how. All the while Bobo was growing up, she tried to teach him that violence was wrong. But this spring, he found himself in the worst fight of his life and came close to being seriously injured, and she's rarely been as proud of him as she was then. Because he defended Amit, got beaten up for his sake. He stood up for something. For many years, she was pleased that Bobo was such a softy. Other boys were embarrassed when their mothers kissed them on the forehead in front of their friends, but not hers. He was the sort of boy who would say, "Your hair looks nice today, Mom." Now she wishes he was tougher, colder. Maybe he'd have been able to handle it better.
"I'm not well, Bobo," she whispers.
Bobo cries when she tells him, but she cries more. Bobo isn't the little boy who used to jump up into her arms anymore. He's big enough now to have space in his chest for the greatest sorrow, and tall and strong enough to pick his mother up
and carry her home after she's told him she's going to die. She whispers against his neck, "You've always been the best big brother in the world. You're going to have to be even better now." That evening, she hears him read Harry Potter to his little brother and sister. That night, Hogg makes some weak tea, and Bobo comes into the bathroom and holds his mom's hair when she throws up. When she's lying on her bed, her son wipes her cheeks and says, "Do you want to hear something silly? You know you're always telling me I'll never find a girlfriend because my demands are too high. That's your fault, because I want someone who looks at me the way you and Dad look at each other." Aunt Katrine presses Bobo's big, dumb lummox's head tight to her forehead. She would have loved to see him get married, become a dad. Life is so damn tough sometimes that it's almost unbearable, even if that's the way it's supposed to be. Katya is almost finished with her paperwork when the bouncer comes running in. She knows it's already too late. None of the clientele of the barn could be bothered to argue with Benji about his tattoo, but someone has called some men who don't share the same tolerance of artistic freedom. One of them has a bull tattooed on his lower arm. As they walk through the door, Benji turns to the guy in the polo shirt and says, "Now would be a good time to move away." He grins as he says this, like a naughty child who's left a whoopee cushion under the seat of a chair. None of the men in the doorway is in anything like as good shape as Benji, but there are four of them, and he's on his own. He bounces enthusiastically down from his bar stool as if he's pleased that there are so many of them, to even things up. They don't rush at him. He's the one who walks straight toward them, and it makes them nervous just long enough to give him an advantage. The man with the bull tattoo grabs an empty beer bottle from a table, so Benji decides to tackle him first. But he doesn't get a chance. The man in the polo shirt watches Katya come rushing out of the office and throw herself into the group of men. She pushes the man with the beer bottle up against the wall and yells, "One single swing in here and you'll be drinking at home for a year." Then she spins around toward Benji and sees a very familiar look in his eyes. The same as their older sister Audrey's. The same as their father's. If there isn't a war, they start one. "Benji, not here, not today, please," she whispers. She puts her hands on his chest, feels the beat of his heart. His pulse is calm, his breathing steady. Four grown men want to beat him up, and he isn't even scared. Nothing frightens Katya as much as that. Benji looks her in the eye. She has their mother's eyes, and she doesn't often ask her little brother for anything. So he kisses her on the cheek and laughs scornfully at the four men in the doorway. "Are you coming in or going out? I'm going home, so if you're not too busy feeling each other's dicks, maybe you could get out of the way." The men glance at Katya and the bouncers, and eventually they step back. The point has been already made. It's no longer acceptable to show up in Hied with a bear tattoo. Beartown may have a pack, but there are men here who are prepared to take a stand, too. As Benji walks through the door, he lets out a loud laugh. The men he's left behind are quivering with rage. One of them mutters to Katya, "It's lucky for your brother that he's got you. You just saved his life." Katya glares at the man. "You think? Really? You think I saved his life?" The man tries to smile confidently, but his mouth is dry. Katya snorts. She goes and gets her things from the office, then fetches her car. But Benji has already disappeared into the night, where she won't find him. All sports are silly. All games are ridiculous. Two teams, one ball, sweat and grunting, and for what? So that for a few baffling moments, we can pretend that it's the only thing that matters. That night, Hogg and Bobo clear the floor of the garage. They've never talked much as father and son, and perhaps they're both worried that they might take to the easiest alternative now. There are bottles of drink in that house, as in everyone else's, so they choose a different option. Drive the cars out, move the tools and machinery until the garage is empty. Then they fetch hockey sticks and a tennis ball. They play against each other all night, sweating and grunting, as if it were the only thing that mattered. When the door closes behind Benji, he walks alone a couple of hundred feet into the forest. Then he stops with his hands in his pockets and looks around, as if he's considering whether or not to try to find another way of complicating his evening, or if he should pick a tree to climb and smoke weed in until he falls asleep instead. The voice behind him is both expected and unexpected. "I've never been in a fight, not once, so I won't be much use if that's what you're after. But I'd be happy to have a beer somewhere else," says the man in the polo shirt. Benji looks over his shoulder. "Do you know any good clubs around here, then?" The man laughs. "Like I said, I've only been living here for the past 4 hours, but I've got somewhere to stay, and a fridge." "He's never done this before," asked someone home right away. It's never worked that way for him before. But Benji has a way of encouraging people to be spontaneous. Foolhardy, too. They take the path through the forest. The man is renting a cabin at a campsite on the outskirts of Hied, in the direction of Beartown, far enough away not to be within sight of either town. They kiss for a long time in the hallway. When the man wakes up in bed the next morning, Benji is already gone. The man finds his book where he dropped it, between the front door and the bedroom. He leafs through it until he finds the quote he's looking for. "One must still have chaos in oneself to be able to give birth to a dancing star." Some distance away, a young man is standing in a cemetery firing pucks at a gravestone. He has scraped knuckles, and worse things are going on inside him. Elan Ovitch is dead, and Kevin Erdahl may as well be. Benji is a man who loves men, and he loses everyone he loves. It's hard to have more chaos in oneself than that. Chapter 11. One last chance to be a winner. It's impossible to measure love, but that doesn't stop us coming up with new ways to try. One of the simplest is space. How much space am I prepared to give the person that you are so that you can become the person you want to become? Kira once made a valiant attempt to discuss this with Peter in terms of ice hockey. "A marriage is like a hockey season, darling, okay? Even the best team can't be at their best in every game, but they're good enough to win even when they play badly. A marriage is the same. You don't measure it by the holiday where you drink wine before lunch and have great sex and your biggest problem is that the sand is too hot and the sun is shining too brightly on the screen when you want to play games on your phone. You measure it from everyday life, at home, at its lowest level, from how you talk to each other and solve problems." Peter got cross, as if she were trying to spark an argument, and asked what she wanted. She said she wanted to have a grown-up conversation about our problems. He considered this for an unreasonably long time before he finally said, "I have a problem with you always leaving a tiny dribble of milk in the carton and putting it back in the fridge because you can't be bothered to rinse it and put it in the recycling bin." She just stared at him and asked, "You think that's the biggest problem in our marriage?" Insulted, he muttered, "So why bother even asking if you're only going to criticize my answer?" She massaged her temples. He slammed the door behind him and went off to a hockey game. It's not without its complications, having a relationship that works like that. Kira is sitting at the kitchen table this evening. She's seen the announcement of her husband's death in the newspaper. The bottle of wine in front of her is unopened. There are two glasses beside it. She spins her wedding ring around, 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 as if it were a nut she was trying to tighten. Sometimes she tries taking it off, just to see how it would feel. Cold. It feels cold, as if her skin has grown thinner there. It's late when she hears the Volvo pull up outside. It's ridiculous, she knows it is, but she goes and stands right behind the door. because when she hears Peter's footsteps outside, she wants to know if he puts the key in the lock straight away or if he pauses first, if he hesitates, if he stands out there and takes some deep breaths before summoning up the courage to go inside.